Please stand by. Good day, and welcome to the Vorys Sater, Seymour and Peace Healthcare Reform Preparing for Change conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. Thank you for joining us. Please note that there will not be a question and answer session during this call. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to Tony Ciriaco, partner with Vorys Sater, Seymour and Peace.
Thank you very much. Welcome to everybody. Good afternoon. Welcome to our second teleseminar. Our first one, as you may remember, focused on the timeline and the general application of the Health Care Reform Act on employers. Today's seminar will focus on the many reporting and disclosure requirements that the Act imposes on employers. And as with the first program, I am joined by my colleagues, and I will introduce them in the order in which they will speak today. My colleague, Linda Mendel.
Hello.
My colleague, Jolie Havens.
Hello.
And my colleague, Jennifer Dunsizer.
Hello.
As I said, we're going to focus on the information that you as employers will need to provide. Some of this information will be provided to governmental entities. Some will be provided to plan participants. In other areas, it may be studies that the government is obligated under the Act to run that they may come to you for information. If you look at slides 2 and 3, they serve as kind of the organization of the program today. Each one represents a disclosure requirement. The first 13 are what I'll refer to as perhaps mandatory under the Act. The 14th is are some voluntary filings that certain employers can make to get either some tax credits or some reimbursements from the government. What we're going to try to do today, in addition to giving you the requirements of the disclosure provisions, also try to set up some timetables and give you some sense of why you may need to begin the process sooner to get some data, gather information, get your computer system set up to perform these functions. With that, I will turn it over to Linda to deal with our first requirement.
Thanks, Tony. Starting in 2011, for your 2011 plan year, we've got a number of changes that impact your W-2s. If you currently provide domestic partner coverage to employees, domestic partners, you're familiar with the concept of imputed income. So if you are providing health coverage to anyone other than an employee's spouse or tax dependent, and for this purpose, the definition is a little broader than for tax returns, the employee is taxed on the value of that coverage, and that's something that would appear on W-2. So as you've seen in the press, the new law requires that you offer coverage to adult children up to age 26. Now, originally, that would have created an imputed income issue because children up to that age often don't fit within the definition of a tax dependent. But that was addressed in amendments that were made to the Health Care Reform Act so that you do not have to impute income for adult children. And in fact, the rules for the taxation or not having to tax the coverage provided to adult children is slightly broader than the mandate. So effective March 30th of this year, and that's the date the amendment, the Reconciliation Act, was passed, you do not have to tax employees on the value of coverage provided to children who are younger than, well, let me put it this way, through the date the last day of the year in which the child attains age 26. So if you have a child that attains 26 on, say, May 11th, 2010, the coverage provided to that child, if you do this, if you provide it, through December 31, 2010 is not taxable. So that points out that there's two parts to the new dependent coverage requirements. One is the actual mandate to provide coverage through the date the child attains age 26, and the other is the new rules for taxation, which apply through the end of the year in which the child attains age 26. So two different things, the mandate and the tax rules. Similarly, you can look at the definition of child. For purposes of the tax rules, you do not have to tax your employee on the value of coverage provided to the employee's child by birth, adoption, or placement for adoption, or a foster child placed with the employee. Now, who do you actually have to provide coverage to? The guidance on that came out yesterday afternoon. The guidance says that you will have to define child solely by the relationship to the employee. So you can include stepchildren, you can include children for whom your employee is the guardian, whatever you do. You can define that relationship, but you cannot define it by have any criteria that are based on age younger than 26, and you cannot have criteria based on financial dependency, residency, student status, or marital status. All those things are out now. So again, it's just relationships. And as we talked about in the earlier teleconference, there is a special rule related to employment. If you're a grandfathered plan and the child has is eligible for coverage elsewhere, for now you don't have to offer coverage to that child. Turning to slide 6. I wanted to just segue a little bit into what we're going to have to do to enroll these adult children, because this relates to guidance that came out since our first teleconference. You are going to have to amend your plan to allow coverage of children up to age 26, and that will be treated as a special enrollment event and a change in status event, meaning employees can change their election. So if they were not covered under your health plan, they can opt in. If they were covered under a low option, they can switch to a high option, and they can change their contributions as needed to enroll in a different option or enroll with the child. So this is helpful in if your plan year doesn't correspond with your open enrollment period. So in other words, if you have an October or November plan year, you're going to be able to do this off-cycle and have these people enroll. You have to give written notice of the opportunity to enroll and a minimum of a 30-day window. And the fact that a child has two parents employed at different places, both plans have to offer enrollment. It isn't enough just one. And a question we've received a number of times, and there wasn't an answer until yesterday, was what can I charge for enrolling this adult dependent? And the answer is you cannot charge a separate or additional premium that you wouldn't have charged for a younger child. So children up to age 26 must be treated completely uniformly. If you just have single and family coverage, an adult dependent to age 26 is just included in family coverage with no additional contribution. If you have employee plus one, employee plus two, employee plus three, something like that, of course, the adult child can count as another person, but you can't have any charges that are based on the child's age, no separate premium. I also wanted to mention that you will need to finalize your plan document changes by December 31. You can go ahead and enroll the children sooner if you choose to do that, or if you have a plan year that requires you to do that, and you can retroactively amend your document, something unusual. For those of you that work with us frequently, you know that we have to get cafeteria plan document changes done in advance. Also, for purposes of employee communications, you want employees to understand that they can use flexible spending accounts and health savings accounts, or it's easy to get these account-based plans mixed up. Flexible spending accounts and health reimbursement accounts for medical expenses incurred by the adult children on and after March 30, 2010. But the same is not true for HSA, health savings accounts. So, of course, the employee is in charge of the health savings account, but you would want to help them to, so that they don't inadvertently make a taxable distribution from a health savings account that cannot be used for the adult children, at least at this time. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jolie to talk about another aspect of Form W-2 reporting.
Yes, Linda. In addition to the imputed income issue that Linda was just talking about, employers are also going to have to start reporting the cost of certain health coverages on the Form W-2. So this is another new reporting requirement. This is going to apply to all plans, so it doesn't matter if you're grandfathered or non-grandfathered, and we're hoping at some point in the near future we're really going to know what that means. This new requirement to report the cost of certain coverages is going to start with the Form W-2 for calendar year 2011, so you'll have to start being able to collect that data for next year. This is informational reporting only, meaning that it doesn't impact the taxation of coverage. You just need to put that coverage on the W-2. And the cost that you report is going to be based on the COBRA premium calculations. Looking now at slide 8, you know, like everything else with health reform, we're still sort of waiting on guidance, but it appears that in doing this report, you would include the cost of medical coverage, employee assistance plans, and contributions to HRAs, health reimbursement arrangements or health reimbursement accounts. However, you would exclude contributions to health FSAs and HSAs, health savings accounts. You would also exclude dental and vision if separately insured. The status of self-insured dental and vision is simply not clear under the Act right now, so we don't know whether or not that would be included in this reporting obligation. On slide 9, when you're reporting, you're going to aggregate generally the employer's share of the cost and the employee's share of the cost. And on the employee side, it's going to be both pre-tax and after-tax, excluding health FSA and HSA contributions like we talked about with the prior slide. The requirement applies to individuals for whom the employer is required to withhold taxes, so people for whom you're going to issue a W-2. This appears to exclude former employees and retirees after the year of retirement. Otherwise, all your employees are going to get it. This reporting obligation would appear to present a pretty unique issue for multi-employer plans just because of the way they are structured. Linda, what are your thoughts on the multi-employer plan issue?
Thanks, Julie. I had the opportunity to sit in on a session with some Treasury officials recently where this issue was kicked around. The mandate is on employers to report on Form W-2 the value of coverage, but if you think about how a multi-employer plan is structured, an employer is contributing dollars per hour worked, which doesn't necessarily correspond with a period of coverage. And so without establishing a brand new communication process, an employer really wouldn't have the ability to report that information. So several of us requested that Treasury allow the contributing employers to report hours or dollars contributed rather than value of coverage. Of course, the problem with that is it's not really useful information. This reporting is meant to correspond eventually with the Cadillac tax,
mm-hmm.
and reporting dollars contributed isn't really going to have that matchup, but at least it would give us something we could actually do while somebody thought of a more long-term solution.
that's good information, and for our multi-employer plans that are participating today, something we'll certainly be keeping our eye on, and we'll alert you to guidance when it comes out. Turning to slide 10, there's also another payroll issue that we wanted to alert you to. There's going to be an additional Medicare hospital insurance tax applied to certain high-wage earners. And again, hospital insurance, that's Part A, so the part that you're already paying into. This is going to apply to all employers, and specifically in 2013, employers are going to have to start withholding an additional 0.9% tax on individuals' wages above $200,000 for single return and above $250,000 for a joint return. So this tax applies to wages above those thresholds. Importantly, there's no employer match. This tax applies only to the employee portion, but not the employer portion. And any difference in what's withheld and the individual's actual liability will be then resolved on the individual's tax return. We're going to now turn it over to Jen to discuss another new reporting requirement.
Thanks, Julie. The next set of mandates we're going to talk about are with regard to a report that plans are required to provide to the IRS on health insurance coverage. And there are two different sets of mandates here that were designed to enforce the individual coverage mandate and then also the employer pay or play mandate or penalties. The first one is under code section 6055, and I can't come up with a great name for them, so we're just going to use the code section. And 6055 applies to every person, employer or insurer, who provides health insurance coverage beginning on January 1st, 2014. And again, if you think about this one as related to the individual coverage mandate, the tax year, calendar year makes sense there. The second mandate is under code section 6056. And it applies to the employers who offer a plan that could be subject to the unaffordable coverage penalty. And that begins with the first plan year on or after January 1st, 2014. So it's based on the plan year rather than the calendar year. And it's going to apply, as I said, to employers who could be subject to the unaffordable coverage penalty. And that basically is going to be any employer that has an average of at least 50 full-time equivalent employees on a business day in the preceding calendar year, or an employer that offers minimum essential coverage, and that's pretty much any plan, and that pays a portion of the cost if any employee's contribution exceeds 8% of their wages. And the distinction here, obviously you can avoid this if you've got perhaps a fully employer-paid plan so that there is no potential for an employee to be claiming the subsidy. In both cases, the actual timing of the report to the IRS is to be determined by the Secretary of Treasury in future guidance, and we are hoping that these two reports will be combined into a single process so you don't have two separate reports or two separate timings. Moving on to slide 12, what are some of the information that's going to be required here? The person that's providing the coverage, the plan sponsor or the insurer, must report the name, address, and taxpayer ID number for each enrolled individual, that's both the employee and the enrolled dependents, that is covered at any time during that year. You have to provide the dates during which the individuals were covered. If the plan is insured, you have to tell them whether the plan was offered on an exchange. And if it was actually purchased on an exchange, you have to provide the amount of the premium tax credit or reduced cost sharing that the individual was credited with. And again, if you think about this as being related to the individual mandate, coverage mandate, if they've already got the benefit of a tax credit in the original purchase from the exchange, they shouldn't get it as well on their individual tax return. So it's a cross-check for that step. And also the famous any other information that they decide that they want. In addition, if if it's an employer that is providing the plan, the employer must also report or arrange with the insurer to report the plan sponsor's name, address, and employer ID number, the portion of the premium that is subsidized by the employer, if any, and other information if the coverage is purchased through the exchange by a very small employer, and this is going to be related to the small employer tax credit, and the months during which the coverage was available under the plan. And I want to highlight just for a second how important it is for you to provide the employer ID number in very big, very prominent communication, because Treasury is going to use this information to correspond back with the employees, and the employees are going to use it to correspond with Treasury on their disclosures. And if you don't give them your employer ID number, they're just going to say, I worked for a company, and they're going to give a shorthand name, and you may end up getting information for people that aren't your employees. So that's going to be a potential problem. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Tony.
Thanks, Jen. I want to talk a little bit when Jen talked about their two different filings here, reporting requirements. The second one is more narrow, and as Jen pointed out, it only applies to employers who offer a plan that could be subject to the unaffordable coverage penalty. If you fall into that category, then you must provide the information on slide 14. First, you must certify whether you offer all coverage to all full-time employees. If you do offer such coverage, then you must disclose the length of any waiting period, the monthly premium for the lowest cost option under the plan, the employer's share of the total allowed costs and benefits, and the option for which the employer pays the largest portion of the plan cost. That's the additional report that some employers will have to provide. In addition to the reporting requirements to the government that Jen and I have just spoken about, there's also a report required to enrolled individuals, and this falls under the more broad category or the broader category, so that this will apply to all plans and insurers. So if you're required to file one of those reports, which again should be a very broad category of people, you also have to provide a written statement to the individuals or the plan participant. And slide 15 lists the information that you would need to provide, name and address of the employer, and also a telephone number for the employer's contact. All the information that's required to be reported on the individual would have to be reported on this statement, and the written statement must be furnished on or before January 31st of the year following. So again, it dovetails with the W-2 reporting requirement. To comply, again, with these requirements, there's a couple things you'll need to do. And if you look at slide 16, first you'll need to determine your employer status, large employer, offering, or other. As you can see, the different requirements apply depending on where you fall in. You'll need to track the number of hours worked for all employees by month. You'll need to track plan eligibility and enrollment status for all employees by month. And when the exchanges are set up, again, we anticipate those to be set up by the states in 2014, you'll need to coordinate information with the exchange. Again, as Jen said, we believe the IRS, they've been directed to integrate these reports of Section 6055 and 6056 with Form W-2, and hopefully we'll get some guidance that will make it a little easier to comply with these reporting requirements. Finally, the employer is permissible to it is permissible for the employer to contract with the insurer to assist with this type of reporting, and in many cases with insured plans, that will probably make things quite a bit easier. Moving on now to the third of our requirements, I'm going to turn it back over to Jolie to talk about notice of health care coverage.
Thanks, Tony. We're now on slide 17, and as Tony mentioned, we are going to talk about the notice of health care coverage options. This applies, again, to grandfathered and non-grandfathered plans, so everyone. Specifically, employers are going to have to provide a new notice of health coverage options to all their employees. For current employees, the notice is going to have to be distributed no later than March 1st, 2013. For your new employees, they're going to have to get the notice at the time of hire, so that would be something you would want to add to your new hire packets to make sure that they get that notice. In terms of the required content of the notice, that's set out on slide 18. Generally, the notice must inform employees of the existence of the exchange and certain descriptive information and contact information related to the exchange. The notice must also explain premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions available through the exchange if the employer's share of the cost of coverage is less than 60%. Last, the notice has to explain that employees are going to lose the employer's tax-free contribution toward the cost of coverage if the employee buys coverage through the exchange and isn't eligible for a free choice voucher. So this is a bit more of a limited notice, but still a very important one. Tony's now going to discuss the issue of auto enrollment.
Thanks, Jolie. Automatic enrollment applies only to certain employers, and it applies only to large employers, and for this purpose, it's 200 or more full-time equivalent employees. We believe the effective date for automatic enrollment will be 2014, but there is still a little bit of uncertainty. It could possibly be sooner upon the issuance of regulations, but again, right now we're assuming this is going to be a 2014 requirement for those of you that employ 200 or more full-time equivalent employees. If you do, the process will be very similar to what you do in your if you have automatic enrollment in your 401k plan. You'll be required to automatically enroll each new full-time employee into the plan. You'll also be obligated to automatically enroll all currently employed employees, not just limited to full-time employees. And, of course, what will be very important in this process will be the notice, because employees must be given the opportunity to opt out of the automatic enrollment. So the key here is going to be communication to your employees so they know that they're automatically going to be put into the plan and that they can take affirmative action to not be in the plan if they have coverage elsewhere. I want to turn it over to Jen now to talk about an important communication with. We've been talking about the exchanges, and they're going to come around in 2014, but that will be here sooner than you think. So, Jen?
Thanks, Tony. One of the questions that we've been asked a lot is, can I avoid having to deal with the exchanges? I don't intend to buy coverage through the exchange. Can I just ignore them? And the short answer is no, you can't. If you have an employee or an employee's dependent who attempts to purchase coverage from the exchange on a subsidized basis, you're going to have to deal with the exchange. And the Department of Health and Human Services is required to design a structure for individuals to purchase coverage through the exchange, and it's required to verify the accuracy of information that's provided by the individual. And that requirement to verify is going to be done either by the HHS directly or through the exchanges. We are hoping, with our fingers crossed, that the HHS will be nice to employers and allow and design a single portal so you only have to go one place to confirm information. And not through each of the exchanges, remembering that not every state may have an exchange. You might have some states do regional exchanges, and some states might do more than one exchange. So we can't guarantee whether there's going to be more than 50, less than 50, or right at 50 exchanges. But if it's more than each one that you have to have set up, it increases the complexity, obviously, for the systems you're going to have to maintain. So moving on to slide 21, to purchase coverage from the exchange, an individual has to provide a significant amount of information as supporting documentation. And if they are attempting to purchase the coverage from the exchange on a subsidized basis, either with the tax credit or with reduced cost sharing, they also must provide information that they received from the plan that we talked about in item two, the mandates for what the employers have to provide to employees. The employee will have to provide to the exchange the employer's name, address, and employer ID number if available. And again, this is where the employer ID number becomes very helpful, especially if you're in an industry that has a lot of unrelated entities or marginally related entities that have very similar names. The individual also has to provide whether the individual is a full-time employee, meaning that they average more than 30 hours per week in a month, whether the employer offers minimum essential coverage, and again, that's pretty much any plan that employee is able to receive will be minimum essential coverage. And if they do have minimum essential coverage available, what the lowest cost option is available for the employee's status and what the employee's required contribution will be for that coverage. The Department of Health and Human Services, or the exchange, will then require employers to verify the employer information that was supplied by the individual. And unless the individual provides a waiver, the only information that HHS or the exchange may tell the employer is the employee's name and whether his or her income is above or below the threshold for the affordability measure. And if you happen to be the unlucky person who's told that your employee named John Smith attempted to enroll in coverage, I don't know how you do that matchup. You have to have a process to match the individual information against your payroll records and to respond within the timetable that will be required under future guidance. And presumably that guidance will have a process to respond back, okay, we've got 20 John Smiths, can you tell me which one? There is a significant possibility that the process could vary by exchange. We're hoping that HHS at a minimum would require a standard amount of information and a standard format for the data feeds between the exchanges and employers, but if each state exchange is allowed to set its own processes, obviously, again, that increases the complexity for your compliance efforts. And there are significant penalties if the information is used or disclosed except for the efficient operation of the exchanges. So, again, your data management systems and your processes to protect privacy will be very important here. And the last thing for slide 22, if minimum essential coverage is available but unaffordable, the employer will be required to pay the exchange the free choice voucher amount. And we went through the voucher process in a fair amount of detail in our first seminar, and you can access that information on the Voorhees Healthcare Reform webpage, and the link to that is at the end of the seminar materials. And if you have other questions about how the voucher process would work, we'd be happy to answer those offline. With regard to that, or after that, I'm going to turn it over to Linda to talk about the Uniform Explanation of Coverage.
Thanks, Jen. We all work very hard to communicate the important aspects of employees' benefits. We struggle with the number of mandated disclosures that tend to vary the important design features, and sometimes it's hard for employees to pick through the mandated disclosures to find the information they need. But now the government has stepped in with yet another layer, and this is a new disclosure you're going to have to make, the Uniform Explanation of Coverage. This is going to layer on top of your summary plan description. That doesn't go away. As yet, none of our mandated disclosures go away. So this will just be something new. And on the positive side, it may facilitate an apples-to-apples comparison among an employee's options, both through his or her employer and individually. HHS is going to provide standards for a summary of benefits and coverage explanation. We're going to get guidance on this by March 2011, and it's going to be done in consultation with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and a work group. So they're going to get input from various interest groups, hopefully from employers groups also. And the statute, the law gives some parameters as to how this is going to be set up. It cannot be more than 4 pages, and it can't use print smaller than 12 points. It has to be culturally and linguistically appropriate. I don't know if that means we're going to have more than one version, because it's a little hard to think how one version would be appropriate for all groups in the United States. Understandable by the average participant. Again, different companies have different average participants. It will have to include quite a number of items. It's going to use uniform definitions of various terms. It's going to have to describe the coverage, including cost sharing, deductibles, coinsurance, copayments. It's going to have to include the exceptions, the exclusions, the limits. That's always something we try to include in our disclosures, because as we found out from litigation over the years, if you don't disclose an exception or exclusion, it doesn't exist. It will have to describe all benefits that HHS considers to be essential benefits, a term that's not yet defined. It has to include renewability and continuation of coverage provisions. Hopefully they're going to let us reference an explanation of COBRA outside of the 4 pages, because as we've seen from the Department of Labor's model explanation of COBRA, that could easily take up 2 of the 4 pages just itself. And again, that's something the government has given us as the gold standard, so it's hard to imagine how we would parse that down to something less. So hopefully when they talk about continuation of coverage provisions, it's just a reference to look for COBRA provisions elsewhere. It's going to have a coverage facts label, which we believe is going to look something like the nutrition label on a soup can, with examples to illustrate common benefit scenarios, so maternity expenses or cancer treatment or something like that. It's going to have to give individuals information as to whether this is minimum essential coverage, but of course that's not saying much. Pretty much any employer plan, any medical plan is minimum essential coverage. And then something slightly more complex, whether the plan pays 60% of the cost of coverage, and that isn't 60% of the premium, that's 60% of the totality of cost. It will have to have sort of a standard disclaimer that it's only a summary and provide a contact number for participant questions. So most of you do have people who are knowledgeable and able to staff that sort of line, or you outsource that function, so that number will have to be available, and a web address where a person can get a policy, a copy of the full policy or certificate or presumably summary plan description. We're going to get a sneak peek. As I've said, the guidance on this is supposed to come out by March 2011, but we should get a sneak peek at this a little sooner, because HHS is supposed to use something along the same lines in its description of the high-risk pool. So, again, in our first teleconference, we talks about the fact that there will be these high-risk pools for uninsured individuals that have nothing to do with employer coverage. It's just for individuals who don't have employer coverage and can't buy individual coverage. But when HHS comes out with guidance on the uniform explanation of coverage available through the high-risk pools, that'll give us some hint as to what this, the employment-based uniform explanation of coverage will look like. So we'll get the guidance, we'll get a hint this year, we'll get the guidance next year, and then in 2012, we will have to start using this for all new enrollees. The access that we can provide this either in paper or electronic form, we don't yet know whether that is going to be subject to, if we're going to go electronic, if we're going to be subject to the rather cumbersome Department of Labor limits on using electronic disclosure, or whether this will be a little bit more liberal. You're definitely going to be using it because the willful failure to provide the summary is subject to a $1,000 fine per enrollee. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tony for another interesting and potentially troublesome change.
Thanks a lot, Linda. I'm going to touch on the next two requirements beginning on slide 27. The first is something that dovetails really with what Linda just talked about, the uniform explanation. This is really a revision to kind of the rules we're familiar with summaries of material modifications. If a change is made to the uniform explanation, when those become necessary in 2012, you as the employer will be obligated to notify your employees 60 days in advance of that change. And again, with some type of summary of material modification or some written notice of that change. Where this becomes very important is in open enrollment process. Most of the employers we work with, open enrollment might run a month to 6 weeks before the beginning of the plan year, and in most situations, some change has been made to the plan's benefits going into the next year, either a change in copay or a change in deductible. That would necessitate this 60-day requirement. So it will impact when we start our open enrollment process. We'll probably have to start them at least 60 days in advance once these uniform explanations come online. Looking at slide 28, the eighth requirement really is not really a disclosure requirement. It's a fee requirement. The payment of a fee, the Act requires some research be done on patient-centered outcomes. And in order to pay for that research, all plans get to pony up some money. Each plan beginning for calendar year plans with the 2012 plan year and for the next, and basically for seven plan years, will pay a per participant fee. The first year it's $1, and it's $2 in the second year, and it could be indexed, multiplied by the average number of lives covered under the plan. So it's more than just employees. It includes dependents. And really the key to this, once we get some guidance, is how we're going to determine average number of lives. So again, as in most of these other things, once we get guidance, we'll be able to give you some heads up on how to calculate that fee that you'll need to pay. Slide 29 basically talks about what plans are excluded. Does not apply to dental or vision or certain other accepted benefits. Self-insured plans, this fee will need to be paid by the sponsor. For insured plans, it's paid by the insurer, paid to the IRS. And again, we'll expect some additional information as to the form and timing of how we do that. Moving on to the ninth requirement, I'll turn it back to Jolie Haven.
Thanks, Tony. The ninth requirement addresses new quality of care reports, and this is somewhat similar to what Tony was just talking about, and it'll be interesting to see how it flows together. This requirement applies to non-grandfathered plans only, and again, we're hoping for guidance soon as to what exactly it means to be grandfathered or non-grandfathered. But this specific requirement says that by March 23rd, 2012, HHS is going to develop a process to collect information from all plans regarding benefits and provider reimbursement structures as related to the list of bullet point information there. So we're going to be, they're going to be collecting information on plan designs to improve medical outcomes, activities to prevent hospital readmissions, activities to improve patient safety and reduce medical errors, and also wellness programs and health promotion activities, which are, you know, your typical smoking cessation, weight management, wellness programs. After guidance is issued, plans are going to be required to make a report of this information to HHS annually. There is some discretion for HHS to make exceptions to the reporting requirement for plans that, quote-unquote, substantially meet the goals of providing quality of care, but we don't yet know exactly how that's all going to work. You have to make this report. HHS is going to establish penalties for the failure to report, so there is going to be some money tied to it. Another reason this report is so important is that it's very public. The reports are going to be published on HHS's website, and in addition to that, the reports are going to have to be made available to participants during open enrollment. So everything you report is going to be known by everyone, including your participants. So this is one to keep your eye on when we get closer to the compliance date. We're now going to go to Linda to discuss some additional disclosures.
Thanks, Jolie. Number 10, transparency disclosure. Well, if an insurer wants to sell insurance on an exchange, the insurer is going to have to jump through a number of hoops, and these relate to transparency. The insurer is going to have to disclose its claims payment policies and practices, some financial information, data on enrollment, disenrollment, the number of claims that are denied, its rating practices, cost sharing with respect to out-of-network coverage, something that's been in the news and somewhat controversial the last couple years, participant rights, and any other information that HHS wants. Okay, so that's understandable. What is a little puzzling is that these transparency disclosures were extended to group health plans. We're not talking about group health plans that have any connection with the exchanges, just regular group health plans. So it is unclear how HHS intends to apply these transparency disclosures to group health plans. For example, what sort of financial information might you have to provide? The good news is that you don't have to do anything until there is guidance published, and we expect that that wouldn't be any sooner than 2014 to coincide with the exchanges. But when it is required, you are going to have to provide at least some of these elements. Hopefully, some will relate to the TPAs, your third-party administrator's practices, and not necessarily on a plan-by-plan basis. But we'll just have to wait for guidance on that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jen for number 11.
Thanks, Linda. The next one of the mandates we're going to talk about for a couple minutes is a certification of compliance with the Electronic Data Interchange Standard. As you may recall, under HIPAA, one of the benefits we were going to see with standardized claims processing and vendors were supposed to work with and to develop a standard way of exchanging data between providers and plans. And one of the ways that they have now found in this bill to increase compliance and up the ante for that standardization process is to require employers and plan sponsors to certify compliance with the electronic data standard. So the first thing you have to do is amend all of your contracts with all of your service providers to explicitly require the vendor to comply with the electronic data interchange standards. I'm going to just refer to that as the EDI standards. And the provider has to also agree to give the plan sponsor documentation of that compliance. The employer must also file a statement with HHS certifying that the plan's data and information systems comply with all of the applicable EDI standards as revised, and has to provide supporting documentation required by HHS, specifically including a demonstration that the plan has performed end-to-end testing with providers for each transaction type. So, what standards do employers have to certify that compliance with? Well, by December 31st, 2013, if you look on slide 35, we've got a list of plans will have to certify with regard to the electronic fund transfers to pay providers, the eligibility screens, the health claim status process, health care payments, and remittance advices. And then by December 31st, 2015, you have to certify compliance with the health claims or equivalent and counter information, enrollment and disenrollment, premium payment status, health claim attachment, the referral process, and authorization. So there are several of these compliance standards that plans don't currently get involved with. They just pass off to their insurer as TPA, and now they're going to have to require certification on a wide number of areas. There are significant penalties for a major medical plan that fails to certify. The penalty is $1 per covered life per day until a complete certification is filed, and that $1 rate is actually indexed for inflation at the rate of medical inflation. The penalty is doubled if the plan knowingly files an inaccurate or incomplete certification, so you can't just file what you've got and hope it's good enough. You actually have to hold yourself to gather the information. And the penalty will be collected by the IRS in filings that are due by November 1st, 2014, and annually thereafter. Most plans have historically counted on their insurer or TPA to monitor and comply with these standards, and these new requirements will require plans to take a more active role in that process. And now I'm going to turn it over to Jolie for the 12th mandate.
Looking at slide 37, earlier in the presentation we talked about some new W-2 reporting requirements. 1099s aren't left out. There's also an expanded form 1099 reporting requirement. Beginning in 2012, your accounts payable systems are going to have to be able to comply with this new requirement. And the new requirement essentially is that a 1099 must be issued for any payment, so we're talking about goods or services, in excess of $600 made to a corporation. So not just to individuals, to corporations. The presumption here being that income is going to be reported more diligently if 1099s are issued. Something important to realize about this requirement is that it is considerably broader than healthcare. So we're going to be talking about, you know, expenditures over $600 for office supplies or a lot of other mundane things that you may purchase from corporations will now require a 1099. Moving on to slide 38. Tony mentioned at the beginning there are a couple of studies that we wanted to make you aware of. Some HHS studies and some GAO studies that are required by the Act. There's nothing that you need to affirmatively do at this point related to these studies. Again, we just want you to be aware of them in case you get contacted to provide data relevant to one of the studies. The HHS is required to study both fully insured and self-insured group markets and make a report to Congress by March 23, 2011. This report's going to include, you know, various employer characteristics and the additional information that's set out on slide 38. In addition, as discussed on slide 39, HHS is also required to work with the Department of Labor to perform a study on self-insured plans. There is, at this point anyway, no due date for this study. The content of that study is set out on slide 39, and essentially they're going to be studying self-insured plans and probably doing some comparisons to the fully insured market. Tony's now going to discuss the GAO study that we mentioned.
Thanks, Joey. Not to be left out, the Government Accounting Office, they get to do a study. They're going to review denials of coverage and denials of applications for insurance. Their report is due to the Department of Labor and to HHS by March 23, 2011. So as Jolie said, you may be contacted to provide that type of information. I'm going to turn it back over to Linda. As I said in the beginning, the 14th requirement is really these are voluntary filings that certain employers may make. And Linda is going to talk about the retiree reinsurance program.
Thanks, Tony. Since our first teleconference, some guidance has come out on the retiree reinsurance program. That's the program where an employer can get reimbursed for 80% of the cost of claims incurred between $15,000 and $90,000 for a retiree age 55 through 64, so the pre-Medicare eligible retirees. It is going to be available for claims incurred after June 1, but the application is not yet published. It will be published, or HHS has told us it will be published in June. If you're interested in this, you want to be working with your actuary to get ready, because this is going to be on a first-come, first-served basis. There's $5 billion, which kind of sounds like a lot until you think about how broadly this is available, not just to single-employer plans, but to multi-employer plans, to the retiree divas that came out of the auto industry, and state and local governments that have huge unfunded, or they haven't saved to pay for their retirees, very rich retiree benefits. So first come, first serve, there's going to be a certification process, and then you start submitting claims along the lines of how you have submitted claims for the retiree drug subsidy, the Medicare retiree drug subsidy, if you've been doing that. So we're coming up against the time deadline. I don't want to talk about this very more, but if you have questions, please feel free to contact one of us because you want to be in there applying as soon as possible. And with that, I am going to turn it back to Jen.
Thanks. The materials include some information. If you happen to be one of the small employers that can qualify for the small business tax credit, the information we think you'll need to gather in order to be able to claim the credit. Given the time, I'm not going to spend any time really talking about it. I just wanted to point out that the information is available, and we refer you to the slide. With that, I'm going to turn it back to Tony.
Thanks a lot, Jen. That really brings our program to a close. I want to turn your attention to slide 45. Our next program is on June 11th, and hopefully by then, well, we know we're going to have a lot more guidance, so we're going to give you a summary of that available guidance. Also, we're going to focus on communication issues that you'll need to consider with your employees. And finally, if time permits, we're going to try to create some case studies to try to hit some examples that may apply to your situation so you can see these provisions in a real-life situation. Slide 46, obviously, is our usual caveat. We're going to get some changes. We're going to get some guidance that may change some of the things we've said today. And finally, I just want to wrap up by saying, as we've said through the program, if you have specific questions, we did get some questions today, but none of them applied specifically to the disclosure requirements, so we weren't able to fold them into our presentation, but we want to strongly suggest that you contact one of us with those questions or contact your Voorhees attorney. Any other questions you might have, please contact us. If you have comments or suggestions on the topic for future programs, please contact Kayla Allen. Her information is on page 47. With that, I want to thank all of you for attending and taking time out of your busy day, and we look forward to having you join us again in June. Thank you very much.
Bye.
That does conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation.